Welcome to White Pill Radio, the every other or so podcast version of Theology on Air, which is an outgrowth of Theology by the Pint, which is a ministry that meets every month in Houston or maybe a suburb to talk about philosophical, theological, ethical issues, all while enjoying a craft beer. I'm Evan McClanahan. I'm the pastor at First Lutheran. I am not joined today by Sarah Stone, the grand poobah of Theology by the Pint. She is out doing Theology by the Pint business, very important. She could not make it, so we are going to carry on without her. But White Pill Radio, it's a kind of a, well, it's more current events focused. This is what I like to say about it. I have to read it, though, because I want to get it just right. White Pill Radio is post-apologetic, ultimately hopeful, applied theology that looks at news and current events from a Christian worldview. And I like to say that this is blessed talk, but not happy talk, right? Okay, so I already told you my name and where I'm from. Marquise, introduce yourself if you would.
Hey, everybody. Marquise Hobbs here. I am the pastor of contemporary worship at, where is it? Christ Church in Sugar Land. I don't know why it just escaped me. The traffic got me, right?
There you go. Yeah. Long drive in today.
Yeah. I do not play an instrument, but I do preach weekly, and I'm a native Houstonian. Happy to be here.
There you go. And Oscar, you say it.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you, Evan, for allowing me to be back. Marquise, it's good to finally meet you in person. I've heard a couple of your episodes. Excited to have this conversation today. I'm Oscar Villanueva. I'm originally from Mexico, but in the U.S., I'm kind of from all over. And I'm currently the senior Bible instructor and chair of the Bible department at a private Christian school here in Houston.
Yeah, so he knows his Bible. So if you if he comes to our Theology by the Pint events, which you should, and, you know, if you see him there and you got a Bible question, like Oscar's the guy that I'll ask, you know, it's like, hey, tell me about that story in 2 Kings when such and such or whatever. So
there we go.
Anyway, glad to have both you guys. Okay. We're going to cover, I said, we're going to cover like 8 stories and we're only going to do it in an hour. So we're going to go super fast, so fast I can't even drink that coffee. But I do have to say before we start, theologybythepint.org, theologybythepint.org. Go to that website, check out all of our upcoming events, what's going on, subscribe to us on YouTube and the podcast. That really helped. We want to build up both subscriber bases, so please do that. Sarah would get mad at me if I did not say that. Oh, also, a new feature to the podcast, very first time we're doing this. Want to shout out Darby, who said she listens to the podcast today. So nice. As people come up to us and they say, hey, we listen to the podcast, really enjoy it. I'm always a little bit surprised by that. So I asked Sarah if it would be okay if we shouted out people, just their first name, but just said, thanks for listening. And if you listen and you see us and you come and tell us you like the podcast, we'll give you a shout out as well. Okay. Well, big story these days are a lot of college protests going on over the
just a few
Israel-Palestine war, whatever we're calling it. Kind of odd. We've talked about this a lot on this podcast already. So I don't necessarily want to dwell on it a lot. And I also don't want to give like oxygen to what I think is a not very organic series of protests, but kind of well-funded and organized, like seems to happen every election year. So that seems to be happening again. I mean, there were people who literally said, I said at the beginning of this year, it's an election year or something. We're going to see unrest this year. It just seems to always happen. So I don't want to sort of give that too much oxygen if it's not like a real kind of organic thing. But it's many, maybe hundreds of colleges and, you know, we get students occupying buildings and clashes with, you know, police and they're, you know, living on the campus. And what's weird to me ultimately about all of this is how the Palestinian cause or the cause really of Hamas has come to be favored. Even though about 80% of the American public is sort of pro-Israel in this current conflict, and the atrocities of October 7th would seem to give rise to a military response, and Israel's been quite clear about that. But it seems like on the college campuses, they are, you know, taking down American flags, putting up Hezbollah or Hamas flags or Palestine flags. This is kind of crazy to me. So I'm trying to figure out if I should be outraged by it or if I should be like, well, the universities also, you know, you've been teaching this stuff for years. You've been teaching children to be radicals, to be, you know, overthrow institutions and speak truth to power and all that. So you reap what you sow. Y'all tell me, what should I think about it?
Whew, that was a lot there.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a lot to unpack because there's a message behind the message. I have business partners that are Palestinians. I was sharing with you. And so this whole situation and what's happening in the world is very near and dear to my heart and to my community's heart. And I've also been to Israel and Palestine twice before. Mm. And I've walked through refugee camps where kids were shot with tear gas and they were shot from a guard tower and killed. And I got to see some of what we call the occupation of the lands as Israel was moving in closer and closer to certain territories, specifically with the Ten of Nations. Ten of Nations is a nonprofit there that does a lot of like leadership development and stuff. And so, yeah, when I think about all that's happening, I think there's a lot that could be said because this is dealing with cultural issues, religious issues that go back for years and years. And yeah, I think I want to be mindful of how I speak so as not to offend my community, my business partners, but then also some of my dear friends.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I'll say.
Yeah.
Well, regarding the conflict, I think everyone in the room can pray that life be preserved, that peace would reign. I think that ultimately will only happen when Christ returns and establishes his reign of peace. To the issue of like what's going on the campuses, I know most people don't like to use terms like cultural Marxism, but I think that it is really an outflow of looking at every possible conflict as an oppressed class versus the oppressor class. And so often you find yourself with very disparate interests claiming the same protected victimhood. So I think you would be hard-pressed to find many Palestinians and definitely not members of Hamas who would fly a pride flag, but yet you have right. members of the LGBTQ community who are very vocal in their support of, you know, what they would see as a resistance by Hamas or by the Palestinian people. And, you know, that seems like odd bedfellows. But if they are both in a war against oppression, then anyone who is being oppressed is therefore an ally or should be an ally, or you should ally yourself with them. Because it's very hard to then blur the lines and say this person's victimhood is somehow more important or more worthy of support than my victimhood. So let's all as victims get together yeah. and support one another, yeah. Which in a vacuum sounds, I think, like a really good idea. But again, once you have these interests that are at odd, I don't believe that a very, you know, strict adherence to the will of Allah would allow for the LGBTQ lifestyle in a lot of these places. And they are outlawed and banned and treated very harshly in many of the Middle Eastern countries that have yeah. a theocracy. I just find it ironic, but also there is a root cause. And I would yeah. say that this idea that, like yeah. you said, Evan, has been pressed upon college students to look at society, government, politics, economies around the world as the winners and the losers, and we need to advocate mm-hmm. for the side of the ones who are at least at the moment mm-hmm. Tread upon in their view.
Yeah,
that's where you have yeah. these very strange bedfellows, like I said.
Well, yeah, the most lost, if you will, institution in America is the academy, okay, mm-hmm. in terms of like being the most fundamentally un-American in the sense of valuing the things that American culture in history values, you know. Private property, capitalism, free markets, Christianity, you know, those sorts of things. You know, the Marxist and the communist infiltrated all of these institutions, you know, in the 30s and 40s and 50s. They call it the Long March Through the Institutions. This is Herbert Marcuse and all these guys. I mean, this is a plan. I mean, and we're sort of living through it. So, mm-hmm. And the problem with Marxism, in case maybe our listeners maybe aren't very familiar with it, but it takes all of the complexity of human life and all of our relationships and all of our financial, you know, systems and all, and compresses it into two categories: oppressed and oppressor. Oppressed and oppressor. And and you have the Hegelian dialectic of taking the thesis, the antithesis, and turning it into a synthesis. The problem is every time you do that synthesis, it moves left every single time, you know, on a kind of political spectrum. So basically, that's what Marxism does. It takes these two categories and then to move from oppressed oppressor to where they can be one homogenous, peaceful unit. You know, there's only really one solution in their mind to do that, which is take from the oppressed and give it to the oppressor until we're all equally well, we would say equally poor.
I think you meant that in reverse, but keep going.
Oh, take from the oppressor. Thank you. Thank you. Well, actually, what they end up doing more is taking from the oppressed, I would say, because what always seems to happen is communism never actually takes place. I mean, in China, the richest people on earth are the people that run China. You know, so it's the people that run the Soviet Union, the people that run China, the people that ran Cambodia, they were not poor. So
right. The majority of the billionaires on the world's list of billionaires are from China. Somehow that doesn't seem to
figure
if everyone is supposed to have equality, at least economically.
So Marxism itself is like a tool just to con people into giving up their wealth, appealing to their, you know, their kind of arguably their innate morality given to them by God while they hate God. So. Yeah, I don't know. The institutions have to be, I would say, radically reformed. And I would say this is another example. And we kind of talk about this a lot on this program. But, you know, Christians, I think, really, really, really need to think about withdrawing from institutions that do not share your values. And, because to the extent that we are financing the Columbias of the world. In fact, it was interesting. There are these two kids that were blocking Hamilton Hall two nights ago before it was taken over. And just, you know, two white kids trying to like stand their ground and kind of be heroic and say, you're not going to take over this hall. Where they were just pushed and shoved out of the way. No police around to help them. And they did take over Hamilton Hall. And then the next day, the people that took it over were complaining that they were hungry and thirsty and, you know, so forth. That was a joke. But one of those kids was Doug Wilson's grandson. You know, Doug Wilson, the pastor of Christ Presbyterian Church in Moscow, Idaho, kind of famous. He was just on Tucker Carlson, just on Charlie Kirk's podcast talking about Christian nationalism, which actually people should listen to. I think it's quite interesting. And he's far from perfect, but I'm kind of a fan of a fair amount of what he stands for and says. It was kind of interesting. So there, it was like, well, wait a minute. This is a guy who's like spearheading a movement of like in many respects, you know, an explicit Christianity, you know, in a secular culture, and his kids go to Columbia or his grandkids. On the other hand, maybe that's exactly where Christians need to be, you know, is going into those spaces that are largely lost to, you know, Marxism. And I don't know what the answer to that is, but.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you enter into the academy, specifically a non-Christian academy, you enter into the throes of the secular world. And what's also to say is I have some friends and know of some people that even go to Christian undergrads, and the morals there may be in the laws, but they're not adjudicated, if you will. So some of the students also participate in some of the largest parties and those sorts of things. Yeah.
Let me tell you about my seminary days.
Right. I think what's interesting, though, with some of these universities where you see the protests and the like, I just recently heard that Brown University actually got to reach a peace agreement with the protesters because they said in October, we will review a way of possibly divesting our funds from Israel. And the group that was doing the protests, et cetera, said, all right, fine. That's good for us. We'll disperse. And so when I think about like the situations that are going on, like I said, my business partner is from Palestine and he's lost family members to the attacks and that sort of stuff. So I'm very mindful of it. But I do wonder what is a way to appease these public groups and these protesters? Is there a way to move forward where universities, without the use of violent force, can say, hey, here's a solution to disperse? Because even at Emory University, that's where I went for my master's at Candler, there was a professor there who was walking trying to help a student, and police just grabbed her, threw her face in the concrete. It was all over the news. Mm-hmm. And so I think if we don't get a handle, or the universities don't get a handle on this in a very sensitive way without involvement of too much local police, then this could continue to escalate and build and build and build.
Well, I think the problem is that they're taking over buildings, they're camping. And so protesting, yes, but even in America, even with the First Amendment, you still have to protest peacefully and assemble peacefully. And often on private property, you have to get a permit to do so. Right. You don't have a right to camp. Okay. You don't have a right to take a public space and live there, you know, and say, I'm going to live here until Israel meets my demands. Okay. Israel doesn't care. Israel is going to do what Israel is going to do. And, Brown, by the way, got its name from a guy who like made a fortune building slave ships, you know, so,
Wouldn't be surprised, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, the North made the slave ships, okay? So the North isn't innocent either. But anyway, so, yeah, I mean, I think the problem is it's like negotiating with terrorists, though. I mean, they are going on a campus and saying, hey, we're never going to leave. And so the university is like, okay. No, what the university should do is, if you're not a student here, get off our property, you're trespassing. If you are a student here, you're expelled. The problem would solve itself overnight. But there are no consequences, it seems like. And, you know, so I think that they're doing things that they don't have a right to do. And then there's a broader question going on of like, in fact, just today, I think Thomas Massie, House rep from Kentucky, is putting forth a bill that makes like anti-Semitic hate speech illegal. And Abbott said the same thing. Abbott said he cleared out UT's campus of these protesters because it was anti-Semitic language. Well, wait a minute. That actually is protected by the First Amendment. Because now we're into territory where, like, if you followed Candace Owens leaving Daily Wire and her big beef with Ben Shapiro, that was in large part about her. She was saying, you people are accusing me of anti-Semitism when what I'm doing is protesting Israel's military application.
Right.
Those are different things.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not anti-Semitic. I don't have anything against Jewish people, but I think Israel as a nation state has gone above and beyond in the way that they are fighting this particular war. That's a legitimate conversation to have. I don't really have any say in it. I'm pretty much just don't want America involved. Israel doesn't need our money, and I wish we'd just back out of the whole thing.
Just going to say, in terms of like what ought Christians to think about this, and let's just maybe pick an issue regarding free speech. You know, I think the fact that the United States has free speech as one of its like cornerstone foundational rights is a huge blessing. I mean, the fact that you can have dissent, vocal dissent.
And a Christian blessing.
Sure. And to criticize your politicians, to criticize your leaders, I think this is a real blessing that is very rare, if not unique, in its application throughout American history. But like you mentioned, Evan, the hate speech itself is protected. Like, mm-hmm. You can vocalize your distaste, even your disgust, and your right to say it exists. Now, you're not protected from the consequences of maybe retaliation. And I'm not a person that thinks that speech is violence itself, right? Like, there are people who would say that speech are actions.
Silence is also violence.
Speech though, so. Acts are violent. And yes, silence can be violence to some people. Yeah. But I want us to think about, or to have the audience consider, that there's a very, I think, clear distinction between what is legal in a society and what is moral according to the Word of God. Mm. And the Bible does not allow us to hate others. We are to love our enemies. We are to pray for those who persecute us. We are to, by our good behavior, in some sense, put them to shame as if we were heaping coals upon their head. And so anyone who says, you know, I can express my distaste, I can express my disgust in a hateful way because it's protected by the Constitution, as if the Constitution overrides the command to love one another, is doing it wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's interesting too, in some of these protests, I know we got to keep moving to another topic, is that the anti-Semitism, once that claim is thrown out, then it pretty much instigates the other side of saying, all right, we have to shut this down. We have to do force. We can't do this. But in some of these crowds in the more public spaces, like I think in D.C. they had a march, and in Austin they had a march. Some of our Jewish, I'll call them cousins, because we're all a part of the same family tribe, right? Some of our Jewish cousins were actually out there marching as well, because it's not so much against Israel as a country as much as it's against the amount of force that's being used to push and to destroy and that sort of thing. And it's a very complex situation at the end of the day. And I think to your point, what we were talking about with the Christian morals and to love people, et cetera, for me, I want to see it come to a close so that we can have restoration of people groups and so that we can move forward in a way that brings honor to the land of God, to the territory of God that we all, you know, draw our faith from in a way.
I would say, you know, y'all made me think of kind of what it might look like to love our enemy. I wonder if someone could go, I guess with an American flag, I don't think I'd wrap myself in an Israeli flag, but you know, an American flag is equally triggering apparently to these protests. But if you wrapped yourself or carried an American flag and took you know, cold water to these protesters, you know, because I think about what Paul says, you know, like if your enemy is hungry, give them something to eat. If they're thirsty, mm-hmm. give them something to drink. And doing this, you heap burning coals on their head. So it's like, I wonder if that could be a movement to these, to, you know, to where if Christians could get together and like make food, you know, not pork, but, you know, make food and water and go above and beyond and saying, you know what? This is how I'm going to show love toward you. I don't know. Maybe that would just be a sign of weakness and they'd get rolled. I don't know. That's my instinct. But what's also funny culturally too is like the rise of the like the frat boy and the jock, okay, who have been villainized, you know, in like every 80s movie ever, right?
Hey guys, Sarah Stone here. Sorry to interrupt what I'm sure is a riveting podcast episode, but Theology by the Pint needs your help to continue providing these podcasts, offering our in-person events, and growing so we can bring thoughtful conversation and the hope of the gospel to a world that's increasingly walking away from church and from faith. Now that we're a 501c3 nonprofit, all donations are tax deductible, so we've crunched the numbers, and if each listener of this episode gave just $1 for each episode you listen to, we'd put a huge dent in our annual budget. So consider giving today. Go to theologybythepint.org/give and click the link to donate. Thanks so much, and now back to our show.
And now they're like kind of heroic because they're the guys when these crowds are like trying to take down the American flag, you know, on these campuses, they're like not letting it touch the ground. So like all of a sudden these like white boy jocks who I probably wouldn't like very much, but all of a sudden they're like, no, you're not taking down the flag, you know, or, you know, this is not okay. So that's kind of a pop culture dynamic, kind of a throwback to the 80s in a real way. Like these guys who have been kind of just like the party boys. In fact, there was a congressman from Georgia and it was a picture of these frat boys like holding this huge American flag, like not letting it touch the ground. And he said something like, and I don't necessarily agree with the words, but he said like, may God bless you in your endeavors. May your solo cup overfloweth. <You know? laughs> In fact, there was a GoFundMe established for these guys to have a party. You know, I don't know how much money's in it, but I would be willing to guess thousands and thousands of dollars like is going to that. So there's kind of some interesting pop culture references. All right, Oscar, we are putting in the clutch, changing gears, doing something totally different. What is going on? What is this article about cell phones and when we should give them to young children?
Well, I think the entire world is now having to grapple with how we are interacting with technology. And the French government commissioned a study. So Emmanuel Macron commissioned a study where their teenage population was analyzed, observed. And so recently France put out a basically like a public health announcement that kids ought to be prevented, totally prevented from owning a cell phone until at the very least they turn 13. Mm-hmm. And you know, I wanted to bring this up as someone who teaches students, you know, in this age range, or you know, maybe a little bit older. Sorry, actually a little bit older. Mm-hmm. And someone who, you know, has a son who's currently about to turn 11, and the conversations that I've had to have with his mother about device use, not just for the 11-year-old or soon to be 11-year-old, but for 8-year-old little brother, 7-year-old little sister. And furthermore, beyond just this being an issue in France, it's an issue in England. It's an issue in New Zealand. Yeah. It's an issue here mm-hmm. in the United States. And the science is in. Gen Z is the most anxious and the most depressed generation ever
on
record.
And the LGBT thing is obviously a kind of social contagion. I think if you look at the numbers, it's obvious. So that through the apps.
Right.
That are unique to phones. Like I think not even laptops, you know, have the apps that draw us in and stuff, you know.
And so I think to like myself as an elder millennial, you know, things like Facebook and MySpace, they were realities when I was in college, but it was a take it or leave it. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're on it, maybe you're not. There wasn't the attachment. It wasn't the water that we swam in. Now, most millennials are online. Most millennials are on social media. I'm not by personal choice, but people who are currently 12, 13, 14 don't know a world in which Snapchat didn't exist, TikTok didn't exist, mm-hmm. Instagram didn't exist. And for both boys and girls, the rates of depression, the rates of anxiety are up, but alarmingly, they're especially up in the young girl population. And again, the studies are in, and the research has been available now for a couple of years. Jonathan Haidt, along with someone else who I can't remember his name, wrote, the Coddling of the American Mind, and observes a lot of these phenomena with Generation Z, how the social comparison, how the image distortion filters the accessibility, the invention of the like button or the upvote, the share, the retweet, how much that has really affected even our brain chemistry to be trained. Whether we used to train one another on the football field or in the playground with, let's say socially acceptable behavior. Now kids are training one another by what goes viral, by what is upvoted the most, by what is liked the most, by what is shared the most. And it's really been incredibly corrosive to the psyche of this generation that's about to go into college. And it has put them in a very fragile state of mind. And so now the French government and even in the UK, they're starting to really consider just eliminating the access, or at least strongly encouraging that parents eliminate the access for kids when their mental ability is not such that they can put into proper perspective what is going on on their phones and in social media.
Uh-oh, no more Cocomelon, right?
I don't know what that is. Is that a show?
Yeah,
I don't,
you're just idiots. Old, Evan.
I am old. You know, I read a book about technology recently, written by a Christian, for Christians, and it was interesting. He said something like most people, they view all the technology that exists when they're born as like normal. Like that's just the way life has always been, And then up to 40, everything's good. Like every new technological advent is like, oh, cool, my phone can do this, or oh, cool, the internet, or oh, cool, whatever, this app. But then once you kind of reach 40, everything after that is like the end of the world. So, like you get old enough and now technology is a threat. You know, your relationship to everything up to that was fine. And even good, but like now the apps. And so it's funny, like, cause if you listen to people and you look at their ages, you kind of see how true that is, but there is something about a phone that is toxic. I read something today. I don't know if this is true, but if it is true, it's mind boggling. And it said, your brain is more active when you're asleep than when you watch TV. Hmm. And I thought that was really interesting if that's true, I should probably know if that's true or not. But if you've ever had a really like vivid dream, you can believe that,
There was actually a Netflix documentary that came out a few years ago. Have y'all seen that one?
I think if it was about social media.
Yeah. It was on social media and the algorithms that they use.
Yeah.
And it was detailing kind of like a young boy's life and how his engagement with social media created the reality around him. So the more he would watch content, the more the algorithm would spit that content out. And now he's like, okay, let's just say, for example, he's on a particular side with global warming. Right. So he's for global warming. He sees that, it gets us interested. Now he's watching it. The algorithm is putting more of that out and it's getting more and more into his mind. And eventually he turns up to be at a protest that goes violent when that's not even his character. It's just I've been consuming this for so long. Right. The algorithm has been built for me and it's now got me hooked and I can't unhook myself because it's addicting.
The social dilemma.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the TikTok ban ties into this too, because what's sort of unique about TikTok is that it's mostly Chinese owned. And and the bill that actually amazingly got signed by the president who just went on TikTok, which is bizarre. But anyway, the bill, it doesn't ban TikTok. It basically says, though, that if they are to remain on United States platforms, that, app stores and whatnot, that they have to divest. That, it has to be a percentage of American owned or something like that. I'm like, well, why would you think Americans like America? Hello? have you not heard about the Long March through the Institutions? Obviously don't listen to the show enough. So, or other, many, many other good shows. But,
I would encourage y'all who are listening to this, just try it out. Try to watch a video on social media, whether it's like the Facebook Reels, Instagram Reels, TikTok Reels, whatever it is. Watch something you normally don't watch. Watch it the whole 45 seconds through. Two or three times, and then all of a sudden you'll notice your feet starts to change.
Yeah.
And this is going to happen, I believe, more as we're entering into the elections and things of that nature. I can definitely see foreign companies getting involved with this, like China was with TikTok, mm-hmm. to say, we're going to control what you see because we want to control what you believe.
Well, I think China wants us to see trash. I mean, because their version of TikTok has been pointed out a million times is like educational. And like they don't allow trash on it. So it's like their kids are learning about like engineering or, you know, science or growing food or something interesting, you know, but ours is total trash. And they're like, that's fine. You know, they're fine if our, you know, if we don't have children, you know, like if we become a bunch of sexual perverts who don't have families and children anymore, because that's what a lot of social media is. So it's a lot of perversion. I mean, that's an aspect of it too for the kids, is the exposure to, you know, adult content. That you give a kid a phone, it's like, I mean, you might as well give him crack.
It was a quote, when you give a kid your phone, it's not that you give them access to the world, but the world gets access to them.
Ah, it's great. Yeah, it's great. Well, yeah, because you become a product of the algorithm. Like you think you're using it, but that's what the social dilemma is about. It's like, no, you're actually the product. You are the product. Yeah, you know, exactly, it's like, it's like when you go to Circle K and it's like, buy 9 ICs and get the 10th one free. Like, you're not getting a free IC. Okay. They're getting all of that data from you. Okay. And they're selling it. Okay. So like, yeah, the IC, the $1.69 IC, like that you get the 10th time, if you actually remember to scan your app every time you get an IC, okay, whatever. Okay. Like, you are worth so much more than $1.69 to them, you know? So I try to have as few apps as possible, you know, and not fall for that crap. On the other hand, my insurance company just gave me $160-something as a credit because I signed up for their driving app. So like they monitor my driving. Yeah. No, I don't know if they know how fast I go. They said they only monitor when I have fast stops, which indicates I'm driving too fast most of the time.
The phone hits the window.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, well, yeah, I would say definitely kids should really have very minimal screen time. Get kids involved in sports. Do not let kids have, you know, put pins and things like that on your Netflix and Amazon Prime accounts and things like that. And I do not understand parents who give their kids phone at all. Our kids are 13 and 15. We have not even – it has not even crossed our mind to give them a phone, you know.
Well, you know, something that I would challenge the audience to really think about, if you have kids that are getting to this age where you're considering it, is how often parents use the phone as a substitute for parenting. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to this in the next room. I want to be on my social media feed and sort of give myself all of those dopamine hits, and to have to parent would be to interrupt what I'm doing on social media. So I would definitely want to challenge parents out there to ask yourself, are you using devices, period, whether it has social media on it or not, but devices, period, to engage and to distract and to keep you from having to parent. I mean, just a generation ago, you didn't have that at your disposal. So you had to be there. You had to be involved. Perhaps you were reading with your child. Perhaps you were playing a game with your child. Perhaps you were going, you know, having a walk around the neighborhood with your child. And now the device gives you an out. And a lot of people are using it. A lot of people are taking it to their detriment.
I feel bad now as a parent because I have an 18-month-old. And my wife and I, when she was first born, we said, no television, no TV screens. And we kept that until about 6 or 7 months. And then it just became increasingly difficult to keep her occupied and entertained and engaging with her, specifically because my aunt who raised me, she's living with us. And so it's like, what are we going to do with a kid for like 6 or 7 hours? But what we did was we said, okay, you know what? Let's try from 6:30 when she wakes up to about 10, no screen time, activities. And then from there, she'll have a couple of hours of watching certain TV shows. Because things like CoComelon, they've proven CoComelon has that addictive characteristic to it, to what you were saying earlier, Oscar. It actually creates a more anxious child because they can't sit and be bored.
Right.
I think we've lost the gift of boredom.
For sure. You know? For sure.
And so that's what we do with my little one. We'll let her watch Miss Rachel or some other educational ones. And she's learned from that and she's grown from that. But we've also said, all right, now it needs to stop. We're going to go outside. We're going to go walk. Let you scrape your knee, you know, have fun in life.
Touch grass.
Before we move on, you just made me think of something that my mom would always say. If we ever complain about being bored, we came up, Mama, I'm bored. Well, that's because you're boring. Find something to do.
I love it.
You know, go get on your bike. Go find someone to play with.
Or I got a bathroom floor that needs to be scrubbed. So you better be careful, you know, what you say. Because as an adult, I'm never bored, you know. But that's what I tell my kids too. I'm like, always have a book. You know, you always need to be having something to read, you know.
Yeah.
Like every time I go somewhere, like baseball practice or the doctor's office or, you know, anywhere. I mean, I'm either listening to something at least, or I have a book, you know, to read. So kids need to get in that habit. Okay, speaking of kids. And we're going to do more rapid fire here, but this was a story that was interesting on two levels. DailyMail.com, fury after five West Virginia middle school students, should be an S there, who protested a trans athlete's participation, are banned from future competitions as state's AG fights for their freedom of speech. So basically, five girls that I would consider to be pretty brave. They're, you know, in track and field. They're doing the shot put. And a trans girl or whatever, or a boy, a human male, is competing against them. And they opt to not participate. They go into the circle and they walk out. You know, I don't know if they actually drop their balls, but they did not participate in the shot put event as a form of protest. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of this kind of went viral, and a lot of people are like, you go, girls. And I think this is the solution. You know, the trans, there's not a political solution to this. I mean, I guess there kind of is. But like, it's within the power of the women, of the girls. And I'm sorry that they have to pay the price, but they are going to have to pay the price. This is what's going to happen in mass. Like Riley Gaines, I think she's right. And I understand why she, you know, swam, but none of those girls should have taken the pool with Dylan Thomas or Leah, whatever. So
William, what was his name?
Maybe it was William. Yeah. I think it was William. Okay. Is William. Anyway. Okay. But that said, what's crazy about this is that for not participating, they're now banned from future events. Yeah. Like, so that's pretty wild. And when I compare it to the basically not even slap on the wrists that you're seeing from people who are occupying buildings at these colleges with these protests, you know, or in 2020, those race riots, I guess we're going to call them, There were very few consequences, you know, for like Antifa people going around and burning up buildings and things like that. They might be arrested, but they were often released. And so a lot of people feel like, you know, these girls, they didn't even do anything. They just took a zero, you know, which hurts their score, you know, but for making that statement, you know. Or I remember when the Olympic athlete, you know, the guy with the black glove on his hand and yep. in the 60s, I should know his
Juan
name.
John Carlo.
It's escaping me.
Yeah. But he just raised his fist. That's all he did. Mm-hmm. I mean, he wasn't banned. You know, I mean, we still talk about that, you know. Yeah. And we could go on and on with examples of athletes who protested things. So why is it that I don't know why transgender athletes are now this protected class. I think it's frankly crazy. I can't rationalize it at all. So
yeah, it almost feels like for me, and I know I'm gonna get in trouble from somebody listening to this, but it's almost like you want to have your cake and eat it too. Mm-hmm. In a sense of biologically you were born a male, but then you transform your gender into a female, and you want to participate in female activities, but you have the physiological and biological makeup of a boy. And so now all that testosterone, that strength, that speed, et cetera, which we know generally speaking exists in mm-hmm. comparison to men and women, that's going into a sport. And that's an extreme competitive disadvantage for women.
Yeah.
Not to say that women aren't strong and they aren't fast and they aren't capable, but when you take somebody who has the testosterone and the hormones, et cetera, and puts them into an event like that, like shot put. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on, I wouldn't want to compete.
The average woman can do like two pull-ups or something. I mean, the upper body strength is
women. I believe you in a lot more than that. But yes,
yeah, maybe. I know women who can't do a single pull-up. You know, I mean, it's just a different body type. It's different. Right. You know, it's different. You know, muscle mass is thinner bones, weaker bones, shorter bones. You know, and length is a lot of. You know, athletic advantage. That debate is over.
We have a separation between men's competition and women's competition. Exactly. There should be a separate one, I think, for trans. I think.
Well, it'd only go one way. I mean, it would just be men, you know, pretending to be women, you know, because there's no advantage to a woman, you know. Anyway.
Sure. Well, two things. I think it's important that this is a middle school competition. And, you know, granted, everyone has a different precise age where they start to get those advantages from the greater muscle mass and the greater bone density and the lengthening of limbs and so on, that in explosive sports, like in throwing a shot put, is going to give you a natural advantage, period. Mm-hmm. Were it, you know, second graders or third graders, perhaps.
I don't know, man. I don't know. I always got second place in my field day 50-yard dash or whatever, you know.
Kickball.
And the top three or four or five were always guys, you know. So
sure, generally speaking, again, to use that phrase. Yeah. All I'm saying is that in elementary, maybe there would be at least somewhat of a level playing field. In middle school and especially in high school and beyond, there's going to be basically a no contest. Right. And all you would really have to do is to pull up the world record holders in all championship Olympic events.
Yeah, anything
whether
timed.
It's the 100-meter dash, the high jump, the pole vault, the triple jump, discus. And if you were to take the gender off – and you ranked them all by time or distance or height.
Right.
The top half would be the male half. And, you know, the bottom half would be the woman's half. And to kind of maybe piggyback on your analogy earlier, you know, wanting your cake and eating it too, it's really just a self-cannibalizing set of ideas. So if you first really had a major push for women's rights, that's where things started. And then you began to very much advocate for the L and the G and the B, which for a long time it was just called gay rights. Mm-hmm. Well, at least the L and the G and the B understand that there's a gender distinction. Mm-hmm. A lesbian is a lesbian because she is a woman who is attracted sexually to women. And, you guys get the point, but the T is totally inconsistent with the aims of the feminist movement and the LGB movement. Because if you can no longer define what a woman is, or if the definition of a woman is changed, now there's really no way to advocate for lesbian women. And even you're going to have a harder time advocating for natural biological women if you have changed the definition. And this is what's so, I think, just surreptitious and subtle about the entire idea is that you want to fold in the arguments that have been made for the rights of women to increase and use the same arguments for someone transitioning towards being a woman.
Yeah.
But now the women who fought very hard to achieve the social goals and gains that they have, seeing themselves totally undercut. I mean, the fact that you could have you know, Caitlyn Jenner be Woman of the Year on a magazine cover gets to the point of ironic satire. Like, is this real life?
Yeah. What were we going to say?
I was going to say, I think there's a new term, and I don't, forgive me if it's explicit. I think they call them vulva women or something like that. Have y'all heard that before?
That's a new one.
It's a new term that they are using to describe women who are naturally women in comparison to those who aren't. What's also interesting, I think, that's just staring us in the face is that this is a child who's in middle school that's identifying as trans. And it kind of just breaks my heart because I wonder what led to this youth feeling this way. And it doesn't mean that
they probably have a phone.
They probably have a phone, yeah. But I just think about, like, for some of the things that's happening in the world, how can the church step in to provide assistance to the parents and to the kids where, I mean, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, all of us in middle school were weird. All of us were going through things, right? But my heart just kind of goes out to those who are struggling with their identity. And especially in middle school when everything else is going on.
I think everyone understands middle school are the worst years, you know?
Yeah. Oh my
and
gosh.
So to have to be dealing with all these other issues is kind of crazy. And by the way, here's the white pill. Like, Christianity, contrary to what its critics say, really does love and value women. And I think women are greatly valued and greatly praised and actually put up to, you know, not universally, not everywhere historically, but generally speaking, valued very much in a Christian society. And this is an example of the devaluing of women, you know, by literally taking those things that are theirs, you know, from them. And related to that is an article which we're not going to be able to get into much. Maybe we can come back to in a future episode about Biden's Title IX rules that basically come out and protect LGBTQ plus students, but it doesn't address transgender athletes. Sarah and I were talking about this, and she says that if you misgender someone, or if a school does or something, it could face fines or something like that. You've had Texas and Florida basically saying we're opting out. So there's another fissure in this federal state, you know, who kind of is the real authority here, because, you know, mm-hmm. Biden is changing Title IX and you have states saying, well, we don't really care what you have to say. We're not going along with this. So, but you have a lot of people greatly offended, you know, that again, women's spaces are not safe places for women. You're going to have men in those spaces. Even if they're not competing, they can kind of claim a right to those spaces. I wonder if debating this is even like valuable, because I wonder if we're at the point of 1984 where 2 + 2 = 5, and it's not okay for you to give a silent assent to that, but in your mind still believe that 2 + 2 = 4. You have to actually come to believe that 2 + 2 = 5 and love that belief. And that's when you know you've really given yourself over to Big Brother, you know, in the book, like, is when you actually believe that 2 + 2 really does equal 5. And that's what I wonder if what's really going on is this gigantic psyop where they're basically saying, okay, let's put this out now and see if this gains any traction. Let's see how many people will come to believe the absurdity that a man can become a woman or a woman can become a man. And for us to even debate it, I wonder if it like feeds that insanity, you know? Sorry if I'm being too blunt for our audience. Feel free to disagree. Feel free to come on. TheologyByThePint.org. Reach out to us.
Well, I don't think you're being too blunt or, you know, disrespectful in any way. I think when I said, you know, subtle and surreptitious earlier, I'm talking about how language is used.
Yeah.
I mean, I really do believe that the adage holds that the pen is mightier than the sword. Mm-hmm. You don't have an invasion or a military fight in order that people accept, you know, a redefinition of gender or pronoun usage or so on. What you have are arguments being made in the media and then being pushed very strongly. Yeah. And to have influencers that are then advocating. And it's all about tweaking language slightly and redefining. Like it's no longer, it's no longer sex reassignment surgery. It's gender affirming care.
Right.
Cause you want to divorce yourself from the idea that sex is a biological reality.
Yeah.
And it's more about advocating for a particular position and then the difference between gender and biological sex. So just observe how differently these issues are spoken about even just 10 years ago, where you had acceptable common language vernacular that's found in places like the DSM.
Yep.
And now you have, in print media and, you know, you have all of the journalistic entities who have new codes about how they can discuss certain things. Right.
And if you even want to peel the onion back further, I mentioned this documentary in the past, but it's about Edward Bernays and the rise of public relations, which is really propaganda, which was the name of his book. But it's called The Century of the Self. And basically it's a kind of chronicling of how the 20th century, based on new psychological, insights, mostly Freud, but then his opponents, how they learned how to twist language, focus test, you know, basically, you know, turn a thing into a positive, you know, so like cigarette smoking for women became a positive because it became empowering, you know, so stuff like that.
And I mean, there's data out there and facts that show the U.S. government invested into Hollywood to produce certain movies, because if you want to change the people, don't give me the politics, give me the culture.
Yeah.
And that's what Disney was trying to do, right? And with those secret meetings. And so the more this gets in front of us and the media puts it out and we ingest it because we're consuming TV, again, using that, the more it just becomes common for us. And we're like, oh, I'm not sensitive to it anymore.
Yeah. And that, and I mean, right back to phones and social media and algorithms and all that. I mean, that's just the new way to do it. And it's way more effective than a Disney movie from time to time, you know, but let's keep going. Speaking of LGBT, the United Methodist Church. Yeah.
I got a
Methodist here. I actually was a baptized Methodist. I was raised Methodist for 5-6 years. And my whole, both my four grandparents went to the same Methodist church, and that is how my parents met.
Wow.
They were introduced that way. So I got Methodism in the blood. My wife was Methodist as well, from Kansas. So
oh, I know I liked you for a reason.
Yeah. So the United, this is from Christian Post. The United Methodist General Conference has voted to remove a decade-old ban on ordaining pastors in romantic same-sex relationship after thousands of conservative congregations left the denomination in recent years. At the conference on Wednesday, that's today, I think. It was voted on by a vote of 692 to 51. And so basically, we've talked about this in the past. Anyone who pays any attention to church politics at all knows that the United Methodist Church gave this kind of 2-year window for conservative churches, more or less, to sort of leave. I think that was, what, pretty much 2022 and 2023. And so, yes, that thousands of churches did leave, which basically means that those left are all, you might say, more progressive theologically, more or less waving the rainbow flag. And so it's no surprise that the first chance they got with overwhelming votes, because there's no dissent left, they voted pro-LGBT marriage practice and all that. So what is the what does the Methodist have to say about all that?
Yeah, I think that's an accurate assessment of it. Many of my conservative friends and colleagues left the United Methodist Church. They did so under one of the rulings that allowed for it to do so while maintaining the property. And then now they've, if I'm not mistaken, they've closed all avenues, or at least the common avenues for leaving. Yeah. And what's also taken place is they voted to remove the language without taking a stance on it, so as not to offend the delegates in Africa.
Okay.
And one of the other things that's really, I call it a sleight of hand, the first week is usually legislative committees. Second week, we bring all that work from the committees to the plenary to vote on. The first week, they voted on regionalization, which takes the United Methodist Church as it is and breaks it up into four regions. So U.S. can have its own book of order, book of discipline. Africa can have its own, Philippines, etc. They voted on that the first week. The problem is all of our annual conferences have to vote on that. So it probably wouldn't take effect until January. But what will take effect at the end of General Conference is we're going to remove all of the language that condemns human sexuality or homosexuality out of the book before we move to regionalization. So the new book of discipline now does not take a stance on human sexuality, which means it allows for persons who are a part of that community, self-avowed practicing is the language we used to use, allows them to be in leadership and ordained within the life of the church.
Yeah. What are the Africans saying? I mean, this literally just happened today. So
yeah. Some of the delegates
hard for them to like fly to America, you know?
And, yeah. So some of them actually didn't make it. There was issues I've heard with visas. And then it depends on what side of the argument a person is. They'll tell you, oh, the delegates from Africa, they're conservative. They have high concerns. And then others will tell you, oh, the delegates from Africa, they have their own region now. It's not a concern at all. Mm. When the truth is, most countries, if not all countries in Africa, are very conservative. And in some places, homosexuality is a criminal offense. And so many of the ones that I know of, some have decided to leave, and there are still some that have decided to stay.
Yeah.
So it's really a mixed bag with that.
Yeah. Well, and we just had a whole Theology by the Pine event around this topic, or around the topic of homosexuality anyway,
yep,
which did not include the T or the plus, I guess. But it was on that topic, so you can listen to that on the podcast feed. You may already have, or on our YouTube channel. I would say, having left the ELCA years ago and observed all this, this is a Pyrrhic victory. So they can cry their tears of joy now, but this is church killing. So good luck to your denomination. It will not survive long. The support, the money, the morale will all dissipate very, very quickly in the wake of this. You don't have to believe me. Just watch, you know what I'm saying? Let's just see what happens to the UMC. You can't survive this. So you finally got to the point where you can outvote the other people. Congratulations. You know, it's like when Maximus says to Commodus, right when he's, you know, in Gladiator, obviously, right when he's offended him so much, he says, you know, the time for, honoring yourself will soon be at an end.
Yeah.
You know? And that's the stage we're at, you know, that.
Yeah. I agree with you. And I mean, I know this might get me kicked out, rejected or lose my job, but I agree with you, because the minute the church abandons scripture, I would argue, for honor of self and the inclusion of culture, etc., is the minute God's hand turns from a hand of blessing to a hand of correction. And we can celebrate now, you can be happy now, but I think there will come a time where God will have something to say about his people who've allowed for this inside of his church.
Generally speaking, conservatives, cranky as they may be from time to time, they are the people who preserve traditions from generation to generation. And when that group of people who maybe they are a little too conservative sometimes, maybe they are a little too cranky sometimes, but generally speaking, they are the group of people that think old things matter, that think traditions matter, that have fidelity to the written word of God, I would argue, or the written words of the Constitution in a political sense. They keep the thing going from generation to generation. To cut them off, you're not going to have those people, you know? And so every denomination that's gone this route is on the verge of bankruptcy and death.
Well, Marquise, thank you for speaking boldly there. And
yeah.
I agree. I mean, I think about how Methodism even began, right? With mm-hmm. as a strong and very fervent holiness movement mm-hmm. with, you know, the Wesley brothers wanting to devote themselves to personal holiness and to you know, and I would disagree with this, but like full sanctification
right.
and, you know, sanctification up against what standard, like right, what right. is it to be right. holy?
Right.
Well, it's all over the Bible. God tells us what holiness is and what moral perfection would look like yep. in the person of Jesus Christ and in the writings of the apostles that are, you know, moved along by the Holy Spirit. And it's just, incredibly tragic, to fail to see mm-hmm. that one can remove out of the Book of Order, out of the Book of Discipline, the statements on sexuality and what constitutes proper God-ordained sexuality, but to remove them from the Scripture would be anathema.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so the fact that we can't really see the unintended consequences of doing that as an organization that, like you have been saying, is choosing culture over Christ is just incredibly tragic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would end it by saying this. We were recently in a in a cohort where we brought in a coach for discipleship, et cetera. And he was telling us, as Methodists, we always say, for our ordinance, you go before the bishop always asks us, do you believe you achieve perfection in this life? And like, that was a really hard thing for me to agree to. But I knew back in the day, Wesley didn't believe that you can fully achieve it, but it's possible because of Jesus. However, this coach said Wesley's understanding of perfection wasn't that idea of perfection. All things are right. But it was the Greek word telos, which means completeness. And he said, Wesley's understanding of perfection was you will go on to be that all God has created you to be. And I think with the stance the Methodist Church has taken, they have not gone on to perfection because they are not living into all God has called them to be.
Mm-hmm.
They're living into all that they have called themselves to be.
Yeah. Well, to the love is love mantra, I say love is part of a beautiful design. Design, mm-hmm. the other word, telos, right?
Yep.
I mean, so God has this design. He has this intention for the way that we are to live in community, the way that we're to build families, the way that we are to, you know, live ethically as individuals. And this flies in the face of it. So it'll be interesting. We are just about out of time. These good sirs have other commitments, but I'm just going to mention this, and I'm going to save it for a future White Pole Radio because I think it'll be around. But John MacArthur said something very interesting. There's a Twitter post out there where he says essentially that there's no such thing as PTSD, OCD, or ADHD, and basically saying that these are kind of either symptoms of grief or they're kind of almost like false, I don't know, diagnoses for the sake of big pharma to sell medicine and things like that. So, anyway, I said I was going to only mention that. So for our listeners, you can come back and listen.
Cliffhanger,
you know,
yeah.
We're not going to share any thoughts. But I did want to end on an ultimate kind of white pill note. And by the way, with the United Methodist Churches, the Church of Christ will always carry on. The gates of hell will never.
Yes.
So we are going to see these denominations crumble. But I'm not like pessimistic. I mean, it's just it may thin the herd a little bit, you know, John 6 style. But the those who hear the voice of the sheep, of the shepherd, rather, They will always be – the Church of Christ is going to be just fine.
Yeah.
So
I think Albert Mohler put it in a really fun, even graphic way, that these kinds of debates that cull the church get rid of the mushy middle. Yeah. You know, the people that remain are those that are holding on hard and fast to the word of God and to the promises and to the eternal hope that we have in Jesus Christ.
And by the way, the SBC, you know, I mean, these are issues that are creeping into the SBC, right? In fact, there's a book, I've heard this author interviewed several times. Oh man, I can't remember it. She was on Charlie Kirk's show. I think Tucker Carlson interviewed her. But it's something about like the money in the evangelical churches, or like, I think like Shepherds Getting Rich or something to that effect. It hasn't come out yet. I'm sure it's on Amazon and all that kind of stuff, but it's like Shepherds Getting Rich or something. And it looks at like a lot of the funding of what goes on in a lot of these big denominations, and like Russell Moore and like some of his connections. And so, yeah, there's a lot of messaging that goes on in that's why I don't really believe in mega churches, and I think we should have even a skepticism in towards denominations. But there's a lot of messaging that goes on that comes from outside sources. So think about it.
You know? On the next episode of
But last white pill, last white pill, Russell Brand gets baptized. And this is a headline. This is from like yahoo.com. It says, "I feel as though some new resource within me has switched on."
What could that be?
What could that be? Yeah, I'm like, wonder. Well, it's called the Holy Spirit, and you receive the Holy Spirit. I would argue at baptism, but maybe our Baptist friends would say at regeneration, and baptism is a sign of that. Either way, it seems that the man, and this is an interesting trend because he's so controversial. He was so hedonistic. He has this kind of spirituality, if you will, and kind of the worldly sense, right? And actually, that's one of my concerns about his baptism, is that he still is talking like in terms of like enlightenment, you know. It's like that's kind of a Christian word, but not really, you know. So I'm like, does he think this is like the best spirituality? Because that's not really what Christian baptism is either, you know. I mean, it is. I mean, the spirit is the word of spirituality, but. But still, it was kind of cool to see, and he said it was an incredible, profound experience. And I just like that line. It's like some new resource. Yeah, bro, you got the Spirit. So congratulations, you know?
Yeah. Well, not to put a damper on the excitement and the positivity around this, but, you know, like all other celebrity conversions here, I'm thinking of a Kanye West, for example.
Oh, boy.
I say we pray for Russell, and we pray that his faith would be authentic, and we pray that he continues to examine himself to see if he really is in the faith according to the way that the Word of God describes what it is to be a follower of Christ.
Yeah.
You know, because I honestly have this, I don't know why, but I have this sense and feeling that where we are today with the movement of the church becoming more progressive and allowing the culture to infiltrate it more, and we're also seeing some of these superstars and celebrities claim to be Christian but living lifestyles otherwise, I feel like it's a shaking of the earth, and that God is raising up a revival within small churches, I would even argue, those that are committed to the word and the teaching of Christ and being God's hands and feet. And it kind of calls to mind the scripture of Elijah, who was running away. And he said, you know, I'm the only prophet left. I'm the only prophet left. And God's like, no. I have hundreds of prophets and thousands of Israelites. Yeah. And I think that's what gives me hope, is there are churches that are in the shadows that are doing the work of Christ that nobody knows about. But God's Spirit is still alive and is well and is powerful. Mm-hmm. And we just have to pray for our brothers and sisters in the world.
Yeah. Kat Von D, you know, she got baptized a year
ago. Tattoo artist.
Yeah, like tattoo artist, like celebrity, and like she basically is like, yeah, I mean, I wasn't involved like in witchcraft, and I mean, her story is actually quite interesting. I keep meaning to talk about it on the show, but what was equally interesting about her is like she did end up at a small church. Like she ended up as like some like 50 person Presbyterian church, you know. It wasn't like Chris Pratt, who goes to like the equivalent of Hillsong in Los Angeles, you know, or like Justin Bieber. You know, I don't know what to think about him. I think he was almost certainly, how do I say this? Used, I guess, for lack of a better word, by the industry. I think he's coming out of that. There's actually, I think I'm actually surprised to hear myself say this, but he's a guy that I think we should be praying for. You know, I think he's reconciling a lot of really bad things that happened to him. And, but he seems to be a Christian, or in some respect. Of course, he was baptized by Carl Lentz at Hillsong. Well, not sure what that was all about, you know, with that whole thing. So, but then Michael Knowles interviewed someone who had had a tawdry career, shall we say, made a lot of money in the, you know, adult business. And now she says she's given it all up. And then this, so I'm hoping that for these that we hear about, there are many more. And as I've said, I do think we are living through a time where like the sides are clearer than ever. And like the secular experiment has not gone well at all. I mean, birth rates are low, health is low, depression is high. There's not a single metric where you can look at, where you look at the institutions, the universities, the Hollywoods, the, you know, the media, they all suck. You know, they're not life-giving, positive, fruitful ventures. Mm-hmm. And here is the church going, abundant life, joy, mm-hmm. freedom.
Rest.
Yeah, you know,
Sabbath.
family, children, vocations, fulfillment.
Yeah.
And like that's before we even talk about heaven. You know, that's the Hollywood cliche, is like the church only cares about like going to heaven when you die. Well, actually, there's a lot of things we talk about now. So I think at some point there are people who have been in that lifestyle and that whole world at a really deep level, and they're like, I get it now. Like it really is empty. Like it's even demonic, mm-hmm. like in a manner of speaking. So I'm hopeful. He's a very, very bright guy. He's very funny. I mean, I've watched him a few times on like his Rumble channel. He's very, very talented.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hopeful, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, all right. Where can people find you guys? Oscar, you're not on social media, and you can't say the name of the school you teach at, but it's a fine school. It's a very fine school.
Yeah, I'm sure that at some point, you know, it'll be disclosed. We're not trying to keep it a mystery or anything.
Yeah.
But at any rate, OscarVillanueva14@yahoo.com. I'll give you my personal email address.
And you say it the correct way, but it's Villanueva.
Exactly.
So, all right. But okay, Marquise, Sugarland, Christ, what is it?
Yeah, Christ Church in Sugarland.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, that's where I'm a pastor at, and you can find me on Facebook, you can find me on LinkedIn, and then also for anything real estate, commercial real estate, Investream with some of my partners I mentioned.
Yeah, man runs a whole real estate empire over here too, so in a spare time. So, and I'm Evan McClanahan. I do not have a real estate empire. I am the pastor at First Lutheran, flhouston.org. So check that out. And sorry, Sarah, couldn't be here. It's always a loss, but Sarah, we'll get you next time. And in the meantime, we encourage you to question freely, think deeply, and disagree as needed.